hard and smooth, dry, even warm and flat. A huge sheet, as large as a field of iron, polished steel, gives way into ice, cracking into soft sand, silvery and shining crystal dust, each particle reflecting light, refracting in innumerable separate rays, separate and merging, merging and separate, and the sucking sound, cool and slippery, connecting me with all that flowed, with all that passed, with the current, with the stream. I move to what is nearest, to the other I see close to me, to the other I move, to a tree. There are many more in the distance. I see them as cactus and palm, separate and merging. Palm trees which are cactus, palm trees and cactus. And I approach closer to see, and I see tall cactus, whose topmost thorns spread out like the fronds of the palm, gently swaying and soft. And I want to sit in the shade of the tree, but remember the thorns, the sharp body of the cactus, and remember that an incision in the right place will lead to water, and the hard, sharp body will quench my thirst. Being hard and soft, the shell solid, but liquid inside, and that if I am thirsty and have need of it, of the liquid the cactus holds, and have a tool to cut it with, to extract the flow, and know just where to cut, know the place where the liquid resides, know where to find it, it will pass its flow to me. But if but I'm if thirsty and need the flow and hold the tool hold, with which hold, to cut, hold, with which to reach out and take what I need, but know not where to cut, having no knowledge of where it resides, I will cut first here, and then cut there, and finding not what I look for, the liquid I need to quench my thirst, I will continue to cut, hoping to find, hoping for it to appear, inflicting small wounds, slicing whole chunks out, lacerating, healing, hacking, slashing, stabbing, gashing, cleaving, slitting, an incision here, an incision there. Lop, swing again, amputate, distract, desecrate, stone.
Maggie, you saw Max Wall during a performance of Samuel Beckett's play Kratt's Last Tape at the Greenwich Theatre in 1975. What were the particular characteristics about Max Wall? What were the particular things that interested you and subsequently led to this series of paintings that you made with him?
Well, as you've just said, my first encounter with this extraordinary man, to me, our greatest clown, was after Beckett's Kratt's Last Tape at Greenwich, when he came down and talked with the audience, and I had my first vision of this face, which seems to me to be the real face of a clown, a face with no mask, no makeup, a just live in the flesh clown in front of me. And so then, all these years later, when I came out of the back door of the National Gallery one evening to see this name in very big letters up outside the Garrick Theatre, I went straight away and got tickets, went to see him twice in his one-man show, and found him very, very moving. I don't know how else to put it. As a painter, I paint what moves me. It can be anything. I find him very moving. He has this magical power to make you want to laugh and cry at the same moment, which any great clown does. And so I wrote to him. I'd not done anything like that before. Wrote to him, asked if he could possibly sit for a portrait. I was very excited by the idea of trying to paint him. And he replied, repainting little me, I am flattered indeed. I could almost add the joke, what colour? And so following that, Easter 81, the first painting I attempted after the residence of the National Gallery was the first portrait of Max, Max Hall and his image, in which I've tried to paint him as I see him, as I feel him to be, as a man, coupled with his image, which is what most people conjure up in their minds. When you say Max Wall, they think of the wig and the tights and the walk with the bum sticking out. And so I've tried to paint him with his image.
Mm. Your reference to clowns earlier is quite interesting, because even looking at the drawing that we're looking at now of his face without makeup on, it seems to be a very acute expression of the idea of a clown, that is the public image and yet the interior reality, which may well be quite opposite, in fact. And it's that dichotomy seems to be, you know, very evident in that drawing.
Well, I mean, the image of a sad clown is perhaps the corniest one you could possibly think of, but I'm not against corn. I think there's a lot of truth in it, and this ability to make you feel like laughing and crying. I mean, a clown is someone who feels a great deal, and I mean, I agree absolutely with the thing that Oscar Wilde said about life, which is that if you think, then life is a comedy, and if you feel, then life is a tragedy. And the clown brings together these two things into one moment. And the clown's work of demonstrating the absurdities of life to us, I think, is that it is an absolutely fundamentally important part of life. I can't imagine life without laughing. Mm.
So for that reason, you wouldn't presumably have found the same interest in just really painting a portrait for the sake of painting a portrait?
Well, I have been trying in all this work to paint Max. I mean, yeah. I often feel I haven't painted him at all. Somebody did once say to me that the only recorded statement of Rembrandt, the only thing actually written down that he ever said, I don't know whether this is true or not, but it doesn't actually matter as far as I'm concerned. I think it's very important. The only recorded statement of Rembrandt is his saying, I have painted nothing but portraits. Now, if you think about that, it means that the tiniest chicken coop in the tiniest etching is actually a portrait of that chicken coop. In other words, it is particular. In other words, the subject is in charge of him as the artist, and the subject is playing through him. I mean, I can only say that's what I try to do.
What is the distinction, do you think, between a portrait becoming a caricature as opposed to a portrait really penetrating something beneath the surface? Where is the dividing line, do you think? Is it an issue when you start painting?
Well, I really never think about caricature at all. I mean, when I see what to me is a caricature, I think to myself, ah, there is a caricature. But in my own work, I certainly never attempt a caricature. And my work, as far as I'm concerned, has nothing to do with caricature.
Should we look at the painting now that you made from or you made after the series of studies that we're
well,
at
it was all very quick. When Max came to the studio and I'd asked him to wear the first act clothes, the rather dirty white hat, the dinner jacket, the bow tie, and the boots, of course, the very important clown's boots. I'd set up this little stage in the corner of the studio and arranged this black curtain. And I was very excited. I didn't know what on earth was going to happen. And I always begin the portrait with some quite quick drawings to discover what the pose will be. And so the first drawing was him sitting straight looking at me on the stool. And then the next one, we tried him balanced between two stools, sitting on one and his feet in the boots on the other. And more or less halfway through that drawing, I realised that must be the pose. And so I started the canvas straight away that afternoon after only this amount of drawing.
On the first sitting?
On the very first sitting, yes, first afternoon. And this is the only painting here that is done from life. He posed, I think, five or was it six times for this painting. Of course, it went on much longer than that, and the whole imaginative side of the picture, the side where his images changed and changed. I mean, at one moment there were two versions of what we began to call the monster. But there are certain elements which are quite obviously from the imagination in a lot of my portraits, and certain elements which are quite clearly from life, if you like. But I try to bring the two things together. I don't really see how you can make a work of art without imagination. I think I regard the imagination as the most important factor in trying to make a work of art. I didn't see Max at all between October, the one-man show at Sussex, 81, and Easter, 82. In that time, he was living a rather reclusive life, working on a second volume of his autobiography. It was winter, and he wasn't coming out very much. And for that 3 months, I didn't see him, but I knew that he was at home writing. But throughout that time of his not coming to the studio, we had very great correspondence. I mean, he writes the most wonderful letters, and so his letters to me were really the food of the pictures throughout the time I didn't see him. So he reappeared at Easter, and the most difficult afternoon's drawing perhaps ever. I mean, because you see, I'd been working from my internal image of him for all this time, and suddenly for him to be there in front of me again in the flesh, I didn't think I was going to be able to draw him. And I made one terrible drawing after another. Finally arriving at the study portrait of a clown, finally at the end of hours of drawing. And from the study of Portrait of a Clown, I painted Easter 82, exactly a year after Max Warney's image, this big head and shoulders Portrait of a Clown.
I mean, it's possibly the most incisive and penetrating and intense of the portraits.
Well, it's, I suppose, because he's in his civvies, as he calls them. I mean, he's in a grey suit. It's perhaps the most naked of the portraits. And, I mean, a friend of mine said of it that I had achieved, I mean, what was clearly the portrait of an old man. It had the ageless spirit of the clown in it, which, I mean, I was delighted to hear, because that is something I was really trying to do.
But you seem to have somehow stripped off or peeled off the image of Maxwell and got to the person of Maxwell somehow.
Well, I hope so. That's what I was trying to do. And I suppose I hadn't really thought about that till this moment. I mean, it was that hell of an afternoon, doing one appalling drawing after another, probably absolutely necessary to, and made, in fact, made way for what has happened in this picture. ridding myself of my internal image and trying to draw him, and then
coming back to the sort of person
and coming out with, I hope, him in the flesh, having gone through all that.
Another predominant feeling just occurred to me looking at these paintings. Max always appears to be very isolated within these pictures. I mean, yes, there are other elements being introduced, but he's very much kind of alone.
Well, I think a great deal of being an artist is part of the whole thing is being on your own quite a lot of the time. And I regard him as an artist. And I suppose I, yes, do see him as quite a lone figure. On the stage, with hundreds of people, but after the performance, then very much a lone figure. And on the stage, too, I mean, he, apart from the pianist and the drummer, there's nobody and nothing else in the one-man show.
The last time that we spoke, in fact, you have been heard talking about your period of artist in residence at the National Gallery on a previous issue. And, I mean, here you are exhibiting in the building next door, the National Portrait Gallery. And I'm just wondering, now, with hindsight, does the experience of the National Gallery directly enter the works we're seeing here?
Well, I think I learnt a very, very great deal at the National Gallery in doing the studies I did from the paintings there. I think space in painting was really opened up for me. By the time I spent there, looking at the pictures there, being with the pictures there, trying to draw the pictures there.
And did you, I mean, was it your decision to actually show the pictures in what is a National Gallery known for, the exhibition or the exhibiting of portraits? I mean, you're happy that this is the right context?
I think it's absolutely right for someone I regard as a living national monument. This is the right place to show the pictures of him. And people come to this gallery, great many people. Possibly, I don't know, but possibly because it's the portrait gallery, and I think most people feel they know what a portrait is. It isn't something frightening like art. People know that portraits are people, and they're going to go in and look at people. And a great many people pour in through these doors. Thank you.
as we who would have laid, lied.
God, pretty close. Rumore d'ombra. Ombra. 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 D'ambra. Arimembra. Rumore d'ombra. Assembra. D'ombra sembra arimembra. Ambra rumore d'ombra.
There was great excitement on the earth.
In 1914, at Katanning, the Aboriginal school was taught by an enthusiastic young teacher named Anna Locke. Miss Anna Locke was all too successful with the children. Aboriginal families came from many miles around and camped near Katanning so that their children could be educated.
The picture burst open.
The local residents were not at all happy. The Aboriginal camp had neither water nor sanitation, and its inhabitants used to help themselves from the townspeople's tank water from their backyards.
The artist rushed out after
the property owners demanded that the government should shift the Aborigines to Kerala, a site sufficiently far from town, which everyone agreed was admirably suited for a reserve.
And soon the shouts died away in
the Aborigines attempted an initiative.
All this time, Paul Snugglepot's head was
going
round
and round.
On a
Sunday afternoon in June,
Anna Locke
was invited to attend a big meeting.
Thank you. Okay.